title of this message, and it was, I asked God to give me a message for the Bar Mitzvah Yeshua today and the Bat Mitzvah Yeshua this next week. Craig's brother has a most beautiful child who has determined she would like to also become a daughter of the commandments of the Lord. And I asked the Lord to give me some words of encouragement. I will get to those, but as usual, it will be a most circuitous route. At the Bar Bat Mitzvah, the child becomes an adult. And this is both a time of joy and a time of some sadness, and especially for the parents. The child is becoming an adult. No longer that innocent little baby that you knew when life first appeared, come out of mama. And you have to say goodbye to that child. It doesn't mean that the instruction, now that the child is an adult, doesn't mean that the instruction stops. In fact, more accurately, that's when the instruction begins. Prior to the Bar or Bat Mitzvah, the sins of the child are on the father and the mother. Subsequent to that, the child takes the responsibility for his own behavior. Parents need to guide, instruct, encourage that child to walk in the paths of righteousness. And I want to begin this message with it actually is a short review on a series of messages I gave here about a year and a half, 2 years ago, which was on the nature of light. It is actually short. Somebody came up yesterday and said, that was short. I said, yeah. The series of messages was 4 or 5 messages. So, yeah, that was pretty short. I mentioned this last week. Science has declared the vastness of the ignorance of man. The great minds of humanity have determined that we understand very little of the things that we can see, and we can only see approximately 5% of everything that actually exists in the universe. That 5% is determined by both observation and reason, deduction. The observation is there is not enough visible matter to create the gravity that is necessary to configure the universe in its current form. Particles that have mass, immediately upon gathering mass, there is gravity. They come together at the same moment. And there's not enough material mass in the universe to actually produce enough gravity to form this various solar systems, the various universes, etc. And it needs more. It needs more stuff. And they call this extra stuff dark matter. And they call it that because we can't see it. It's dark. They can't see it, but they know it's there by deduction. Faith is necessary whether you're in the sciences or whether or not you are, whether in science or theology. There are things that exist that we can't see. It is true in all facets of our life. And this helps us understand the first few verses of Genesis chapter 1. God creates the heavens and the earth, which are described as existing in a state of confusion or formlessness. It is empty. It is void. There's nothing inside of it, and there's no light being emitted by it. It's complete darkness. So we look upon it and it looks like nothing at all. But as I've pointed out in many messages, that describes only the appearance of what existed. The substance is quite different. Confusion or formlessness. All that was necessary to create the universe was there, but it existed in a nondescript form. Everything looked like everything else, and so it was confusing. You couldn't identify any individual aspect of this confusion. It was formless. It appeared to be empty, a great void. It had no physical matter. Now, I was alive in 1964. It was a year after my own bar mitzvah. And that 1964 was a really good year for science, and it was a really good year for theology. In 1964, CERN, the particle collider in Europe, CERN, proved the existence of a very peculiar particle, and it was believed that this particle suddenly appeared in the midst of the chaotic cloud of energy after the so-called Big Bang, and physical matter started to form. Prior to that, it was just chaotic energy. All formed a full spectrum of energy that we can perceive, and I'm sure there is more. There's greater or higher frequencies than gamma rays and lower frequencies than infrared. But even those that we know, the full gamut of energy existed, and all of a sudden this particle appeared and started to give mass to these particles of energy. They no longer traveled at the speed of light. They now had mass. It was somewhat slower. The Higgs boson particle was sarcastically named the God particle. Why? Because it had the same effect on creation as the voice of God. God said, Yehi Or, let there be light, Vayehi Or, and there was light. And all of a sudden, science has accepted that this particle touched the energy, and all of a sudden, there was photons. There were particles. It was a good year because when I was a child in science classes, the universe was eternal. They took their cue from Plato, who talked about the eternity of matter, and the universe had always been there. And then all of a sudden, in the 1960s, we determined that, science determined that there was a beginning to the creation. It had not always been there. Before that, there was nothing. What was the nothing? I have no idea. As a theologian, I look at it as there was God. Amen. Prior to the physical creation, there was God. But in science, we need empirical proof. So there was nothing. That brought a great deal of joy to people who believed in God. Science and theology came a little closer that day. The universe had a beginning. And as it was described in 1964, we also found out the mechanics, how physical matter came into being. The last description is darkness, a chaotic void that emitted absolutely no light. So even if there was something there, we couldn't see it. It's just blackness, darkness. There is a remnant of this tohu v'vohu v'choshech, this confusion, void, and darkness that exists in our present-day universe. A black hole is a region of space that emits absolutely no light. It is shrouded in what the scriptures call an arafel. It's a very peculiar kind of choshech, or darkness. It's a darkness that can be felt. It's like a mist that settles down and you can feel the darkness. It's the same kind of darkness that existed in Egypt with the plague. The more light you shine into it, the less you can see. We experience a portion of this in our lives. When we drive into, out on the plains, when I lived out on the plains, it was amazing. You could actually drive into an Otterfeld. You could drive into this thick cloud. You turned on your lights. And if you wanted to see more, what's the natural reaction? You turn your lights up on high. But when you do that, you see even less. The fog becomes this, it obscures all image. When we gaze into a black hole, we see absolutely nothing at all. It is a circular region of space that appears formless, empty, and devoid of all life. Otterfeld. This hole was first observed in 1964 when a really brilliant blue star was observed circling this strange dark hole in the skies. We can identify the location of a black hole only when there is light that surrounds it. And that makes a real sharp border between the light and the darkness. The light is sucked into the hole and creates that sharp border. A black hole appears, and has been theorized, we know nothing about a black hole because we can't see it. We can't peer into it. Nothing we know has survived any experience with it. So any understanding of a black hole is theoretical. It is speculation. It appears to be a tear in the fabric of space. Einstein predicted this phenomenon long before we could actually see it. And it operates like a drain. Everything around it is sucked into it. Nothing escapes. This is what we see when we peer into a black hole from this side. However, what is visible on the other side of the horizon of that black hole is utterly and completely different. If one were to enter into a black hole and turn around, what he would see would be a spectacular waterfall of light pouring in from the edges. It would be splendorous. You would be immersed in a pool of light as this light fell into the hole. The light would shine round about. There would be no shadows because a shadow is created if you have a source of light. The other side that is illuminated is in shadows. But here the light is round about. There's no place. You are immersed in a pool of light. The darkness or the Otterfeld I have always found most intriguing, primarily because God says he adorns himself with an Otterfeld, a cloud of darkness. He lives within it. That was the impetus for that series on the nature of light. The darkness can actually be filled with light. But light we can't see. We have no ability to perceive. The reason is you can't see light. It's energy. The human eye cannot pick that up at the frequencies it travels. The only time you can see light is when you gaze directly at the source, and that those photons are coming straight at you, or as that light is reflected off a physical object, then you can also see light. And that changes the nature of the light, the colors, etc. That's why we can see colors. What is reflected off an object changes the frequencies. If you don't think I am, I see a couple of smiles, and if you took a laser and you put it in a vacuum tube and there was no particles within that tube, no dust, no moisture, no nothing, you turn on the laser, if you look at the laser, you can see a point of light. And you can see the glass where that laser hits. But you see no beam connecting the two. If you look from the side, you cannot see a beam of light. It's invisible to us. If you break that vacuum seal and you introduce some dust or you introduce some moisture, all of a sudden, the beam of light that comes out of the laser and touches the glass is now visible. Why? It's reflecting off the particles that the laser beam is touching. Same thing in the night sky. When we look up in the sky, it's black. It appears to be devoid of light, with the exception of pinpoints of light that are stars emitting light. And we can also see things that the light of our own sun reflects off of, for instance, the moon. It appears as this white light that just sits there, and everything around it is absolutely black. But it's not black. Everything around it contains light. And this is observable. Out on the plains, when I would sit and look into the night sky, you know, here in Denver, there's so much ambient light that the stars are obscured. Out on the plains, we have hundreds, maybe thousands of times of the amount of stars. Do we really have more stars? No. But we can see them. They're more apparent. And every once in a while, as you're looking up, there's this pinpoint of light that's streaking across the sky at approximately 17,000 miles per hour, and it's illuminated. The space it now occupies is illuminated. Seconds before, it was black. That satellite is immersed in a pool of light. The night sky is filled with light that can be perceived the moment you put something into it, into that pool. Otherwise, you can't see it. It's just black. This reveals that there is far more that exists than what the senses of man can perceive. Or as Shakespeare put it, there's more in heaven and earth, dear Horatio, than is dreamt about in your philosophies. Is also the first step in the quest to behold the face of God. In faith, I believe what I cannot see, God. I therefore continued to search for what cannot be seen, but I know exists. There's no doubt in my mind that God exists. It's like whenever I lose my keys, I know they exist. I can't see them. But I continue to search for them because I know they exist. I know they exist because I drove my car here. And without that key, my car wouldn't be here. So I checked the window. My car's there, so my key is here. And just because I can't see it does not stop me from searching for that key. Sometimes I find it. You have no room to speak. I found your keys in the freezer. I'm just saying. Apparently she went to get something from the freezer, put her keys down, and 3 months later I found her keys. Perhaps I'm sharing too much. One of our fathers, Yaakov, experienced this phenomenon, the weary traveler. He decides to rest for the night, and in a dream, he sees the heavens open up, and he is shown a ladder which emanates from heaven and is set towards the earth and is set upon the earth. And then he sees the angels of the Lord ascending on this ladder and descending on this ladder. And when he awakes, In Genesis chapter 28, verse 16, he declares this, Achen yish Adonai b'makom hazeh ba'anachi lo yedati ur. Surely the Lord was in this place, and I didn't know it. I added or there. I'm sorry. I misspoke. I can be confusing in two different languages. What could not be seen in the light of day was visible in a vision of night, which is why God often speaks to us in a vision of the night, in dreams. First of all, during the day, we don't always notice him. We're too busy with other stuff. We're too distracted. At night, when we're unconscious, he can get through to us. That's when he speaks to our soul. Who did Yaakov see? It was in the New Covenant portion. No, it wasn't. It is in the same chapter as the New Covenant portion. Yaakov saw Yeshua. John chapter 1, verse 51. Truly I say to you, you will see the heavens open and the angels of God ascending and descending, not on the ladder this time, but he identifies who he was in that vision, on the Son of Man. Yeshua declares expressly, without any ambiguity, he was the ladder, the connecting point between heaven and earth. He came from heaven, was set on earth. Yaakov awakes, and then he understood. And when Yeshua spoke these words to Nathanael, Nathanael also understood. What does Yaakov declare? This is Beit Elohim v'shar ha-shamayim. This is the house of God and the gate of heaven. Yeshua has always been the gate of heaven, the one you must pass through to enter into the house of the Lord. It has always been true. It was true for Yaakov. It was true when he spoke to Nathanael. Yaakov didn't notice that God was there. He was just tired and went to sleep. Completely obtuse to the presence of the Lord there. When he wakes, he realizes, oh my God. And he calls the place Peniel, for I have seen the face of God. We shouldn't make too much fun of Yaakov. The presence of God lives in us, and we oftentimes don't recognize it. So, if we are obtuse, if Yaakov was obtuse, we are obtuse squared. You know, when I was younger, I was aware of who I am, what I am. As I get older, I'm coming undone. Things are falling off me. I'm not really here anymore. We live our lives mostly in a condition of obtuse, unaware. We rarely recognize the presence of the one that surrounds us and even the one who lives within us. We are taught from an early age to focus and notice the details. Unfortunately, we are rarely taught to reintegrate those details back into the overall picture. This idea is revealed in two Hebrew words. In modern Hebrew, the word haloni means secular, and it is derived from the Hebrew word hol, which means a grain of sand. To view only the creation is tantamount to noticing only an individual grain of sand. And each grain of sand is separate, is distinct from other grains when we view it up really close. But when we step back, we can see how that grain integrates into the larger vision, which is a beach. As the psalmist before me, the older I get, the more sensitive I become to this single overriding reality. It influences every moment of my life. God is there. Adonai Shema. He's everywhere. There is no place, as the psalmist says in 139, no place I can go where God is not. If I go up into heaven, if I go down to Sheol, wherever I go, God is there. I don't pray for God to show up. I pray that the Lord will give me eyes to see the one who is already there. He's never left. He's never forsaken me. He's always there. Because I can't see something doesn't mean that thing is not there. It could mean I'm just blind. That my eyes can't see. And this affects how a person lives their life. When I come to truly believe that God is always there, I am compelled to act differently. I will not do some certain things because Adonai Shema, God is there. And I will do certain things, even things that I don't want to, because I know Adonai Shema, God is there. The Proverbs tell us in chapter 29, without a vision of God, the people perish. That is not a translation at all. That is an extrapolation. The word perish does not exist in that particular verse. It actually says, without a vision of God, the people are unrestrained. Without a knowledge that God is there and watching, we are unrestrained. We do whatever we want because we think there is no eye that can see us. I have actually thought in my life, while I was doing something that I knew was wrong, now nobody can see, nobody will know. The foolishness of that statement in eternity is profound. God is always there. Not only does he know, but I will at some point give an account for every one of those activities, for every word I said in a casual manner. I am anticipating a bad day in the future. The knowledge that God is always there restrains a person's behavior. He's confined to a certain path. And as I was preparing this message, the Lord, brought to my mind a bobsled. It is a device that we sit on and it just goes down a mountain on a path of ice, but it has borders. And even if you take your hands off the steering mechanism, which is not much of a steering mechanism, you'll just careem off the sides. You'll stay on path, but you'll just be banging off the banks. And if you narrow those banks, the path of that bobsled becomes straighter. It deviates from the path less and less and less. And so the more the behavior is restrained, the greater the straightness of that path. A few months ago, I dealt with the word tzaddik, or righteousness. And it comes from a root which means to make straight, to make narrow. And Yeshua deals with this in the so-called Sermon on the Mount, which was actually given on a little knoll before the Kinneret, the Sea of Galilee. And he says, wide is the path that leads to destruction. Narrow, righteous is the path that leads to God. Narrow is the gate through which you pass. These things all tie together into one single message. The path of the righteous is a straight path that leads from where you are to where God is. Much changed for the man when he was beguiled by the serpent of old to eat what was forbidden. In the faith of my people, man was created and clothed with a garment of light. Not flesh, light. It is an ancient Jewish understanding that not only was Paul aware of, but he used extensively to describe believers in Yeshua. He called us children of light. As we repent and try to return to God, we are to allow the light that has been obscured in us to shine forth. Once again, to be this brilliant whiteness, so that all men would see our good works. And he equates the good works with the light of God, that all men might give glory unto their Father who is in heaven because of the things we do. When we ate of what was forbidden, we changed from being children of light, we became children of the lie. The serpent of old told us, break the ties that bind you to God. Become independent. Eat this, and you will be like God. We ate. And we were now only able to see a very narrow slice of reality, this physical creation. The presence of God was hidden from us. We also became isolated from one another. These shells, this physical container, separates me from you. But I'm not. Not in reality. The light of God that animates this vessel is the same as the light of God you have in you. And when this vessel is obscured, when it's done away with, when that neshama, that luminescent breath of God is allowed to escape, I share communion with those who have passed before me in ways that I can't even understand at this point. The light joins together. Why do we call it white light? Because all the various shades of the various frequencies, when they come together and share a communion, those colors disappear. All the blues and the reds and the yellows, they go away. And all that is seen is this brilliant white light. It's the same with our souls, if you will. You and I are connected inextricably for all eternity. When we zoom in on the physical creation, we only see a portion. It's like viewing a grain of sand and thinking it comprises the entire universe. Much of our time is spent alone, disconnected from everything else around us. You know, the same stars that are there at night are there in the daytime too. We just can't see them. We are distracted by the intense light of the sun. That sunlight obscures those stars. We can't see them, but they're there. How a man sees his life is quite similar. And nowhere is this condition more evident than when a man is on a battlefield. In battle, a man develops what is called tunnel vision. Everything squeezes in, and this is all you can see. And it's an involuntary action. Your body produces, when you're under threat, your body produces certain chemicals. And that has an effect on your body. And your vision, your peripheral vision is gone. You can't see anything to the sides. You focus only on that threat that is directly in front of you. And if you're with a squad, then certain guys are dealing with the threats that might come from the side. They also have tunnel vision, but they're looking to this side, and other guys are looking to this side. Some are looking straight. And then you have, you know, the guys who watch your six, they're turned around looking the other way. So that you got eyes all the way around. If you're alone, there's a phrase that describes this. It's called keep your head on the swivel. And in your training, you practice all the time. And if you don't do it well, you get smacked in the helmet. You're dead. It's a very poignant indication of what's going on. You just got shot. So you keep your head turning this way and that way and up, because threats can come from roofs if you're wandering through narrow streets in the city. They can come from below, entrances to basements. And so you can't see this from the side, and so you keep your head on the swivel, constantly looking while you're walking down that street. It's an involuntary response. It is not subject to your will. You have to change what your body is doing. A young man lives his life in a similar fashion. He's focused on the details of his life, how he's going to make a living, his family, his friends. If he is a man of some faith, he will even try to fit God into this matrix. Services, Saturday or Sunday, prayer times, Bible studies. We'll try to make room for God in the midst of all of this other stuff. But as you get older, the other stuff, this knowledge was unavailable to me when I was young. But now I'm old. The other stuff doesn't mean that much anymore. My son has grown. He's got his own son. I look less at this physical life. I've had to step back, and I've spent a lot of time over the last decade looking back over my life, where I was and where I am. The mundane or carnal man would simply see the span of his life as a series of exceptional coincidences that brought him from where he was to the place he is currently. Viewed from the eye of faith, the surreptitious is revealed. It's no longer existing in darkness, in shadows. You can look back and you can see the hand of God like a rudder guiding your path. You'll come to a fork in the road, he'll block off one fork, and he'll make smooth the other fork. He's guiding you down that path. You can see it as you look back over the course of your life. That view is available to the youth. We're just too busy. We got other things. That's why youth comb their hair. Never mind. That was an obscure excuse for why sometimes my hair isn't combed. He's able to see through the eye of faith the one he can't see with that natural eye, but the one who's always there, even when I can't see him. He's able to see the hand of God guiding him on the path that God wants us to be. You can only see a very small portion of God in the details. We can receive a much greater image of God's face when a man will widen his field of view, when he integrates the details into the larger picture, and we can see this beautiful dance that God has choreographed for our lives. This is the exhortation for these young ones who are about to enter into adulthood. As a child, I saw the creation through the eyes of wonder. Nothing was impossible. I could close my eyes and see me in any situation I wished to be. I spent decades, for what I saw when I closed my eyes was adventure. And I spent decades, and I traveled thousands of miles in search of the wondrous. I was never disappointed on any of those journeys. But the greatest search of my life has been held over the last 50 years. And it's been the journey to behold the face of God. The psalmist declares in Psalm 24, he turns this into a command. Lord, you said, seek your face. Your face, Lord, I will seek. I guess I determined early in my walk with God that he would not command me to behold his face if it were impossible to see his face. And as I searched for that face, I've been given these glorious glimpses into the Arafel, the darkness that he is shrouded in. And I have seen his light in the midst of that darkness. And in that light, I've been able to see light. To my young brother and young sister who led the congregation in worship today, and God bless you, you did a magnificent job. You know, every culture has a rite of passage where a child becomes a man. In most cultures, that is a ritual of death. We send the young man out alone for the first time to stand before an animal, to kill it, to do something that will risk his life in order to show that he is a man. This is not so amongst the Jewish people. The ritual of passage from a child to a man is not a ritual of death. It's life. That child leads the congregation in the worship of the living God. It is fundamentally different. And to those who are about to and who have just finished leading God's people in worship, I say this. Today starts a glorious journey filled with wonder that is greater than anything you can anticipate. No matter how great your imagination, the scriptures say God is greater than your imagination. There's no way to anticipate, to imagine this. You have to live this. You have to walk that path. And if you will seek him, you will find him. And the glory of that meeting will linger for eternity. It will never fade. I encourage you to resist the temptation to label things. We love labels. The reason is we see something that is new and we label it, and then we can fit it in a category. And we believe we understand everything in that category, and we can now set it to the side and see something else. The innocence of the child sees each thing as unique and wants to experience that thing, to drink it to the dregs. And that keeps that sense of wonder fresh and alive. A righteous man understands that even the most mundane of activities on this earth can be infused with holiness, because there is always something more to learn. God is present even in that mundane activity that appears outside of greatness to us, but God is still there. And the more we understand that, the greater the holiness that is imparted to that activity. So we pray before we eat to recognize Adonai Shema, God provided this food. It's why Jews pray after the meal and thank God for that provision. You know the old joke, in Judaism there's a prayer for everything. There is a blessing for everything that exists. True. It's not a joke. We bless everything in an attempt to recognize God in everything. Seek to walk not only through the, or to see, not only through the eye of the wolf who walks the path, but also the eye of the eagle who hovers above and gazes down on that path. And in this way, you will never lose your wonder. The glory of awe will still be there, even when you're old. You will behold the hand of God everywhere you go and everything you do. Father, I thank you for your promise that you will never leave us nor forsake us, and that ere we go, you are there. As these days grow dimmer and the Arafel is increasing, give us eyes to see. Let us behold your presence in everywhere we go, in everything that we do. I thank you that we are never alone, that we can never despair at being isolated, for you are always there. Strengthen us in these days of darkness and shadows, and may we become the light that will chase back those shadows. In Yeshua's precious name, amen.